creative, and we are just blessed beyond blessed, and I think you're going to be blessed beyond blessed to be here. I was introduced to Mako's work probably close to 2 years ago, and it was November of 2010. Someone showed me the video I think you're going to see today, and they said, we should have Mako come here, and they kind of chuckled and laughed, like, you know, our little studio and our little church at the time of maybe 100 people could do this. But I laughed, and then I thought, you know, why not? And so I picked up the phone, and I looked ahead and saw that the first Friday in April of 2012 was also Good Friday. And I thought, what a tremendous blessing and honor it would be to have Mako come with the four Holy Gospels and speak and be here on Good Friday, the day we celebrate the fact that our Savior, Jesus Christ, went to the cross and died for us. And I called, and we talked, and they said, maybe, and we talked some more, and I called again, and here he is. And so, very surreal to have him with us, and again, just to have the pleasure of meeting him and talking to him. It's been a tremendous honor in the few hours I've gotten to spend with him. At New City Church, we believe that Jesus came back, he's brought his kingdom back to restore beauty. In Genesis 1 and 2, it says that the world was created, and it was created beautiful. And you look around, and God created a beautiful world. And then something went tragically wrong. But Jesus came back to restore beauty, and we see the arts as a way that can reflect the beauty of God's creation, God's original intent and original design. And Mako Fujimura has dedicated his life to that end, and as well as other things that he's doing. And so he's going to share a lot about his project today. And so, again, I'm so glad that you're here. And as an added bonus, Jim Ballinger served with Mako on the National Arts Council. And Jim is the director of the Phoenix Art Museum. And I've gotten to speak with Jim a couple of times. And I said, Jim, would you like to introduce your friend Mako? And he said he'd be thrilled to. So please I'll turn it over now to Jim Ballinger, and he'll introduce Mako for us. Thank you.
Brian, thank you very much, and welcome everyone to Phoenix Art Museum. It is indeed a joy to be here this morning to welcome Mako Fujimura to the Phoenix Art Museum. He is, as Brian alluded, more than just an artist. He is a writer, speaker, film producer, and one of the things that I got to know about Mako over serving together 4 or 5 years on the National Council for the Arts, and Mako, you're happy to know that I'm in the 8th year of my 6-year term. Because no one will approve anyone to replace anyone in Washington, D.C. right now. We'll deal with this being a good day, catch my pun, to be here, not to discuss politics, but... So it is terrific, and I bring those years up just because you're going to hear about all of Mako's successes, so I'm going to hear to tell you about his failure, because he and I joined together in our failure, and that is one of the things the National Council does is behind the scenes we create a list of people for the president to recognize each year in the National Medal for the Arts, and we being the two folks, it's only a 14-person panel that are dealing with the visual arts. How many years in a row did we advocate for Janet Fish? We failed. Doesn't mean we'll give up, but that's the way some of those things go. But I think one of the things that I learned, and you will see today, is this gentleman is a methodical thinker, much beyond his own work, much beyond just the visual arts. And that is what placed him on this council that was a nomination of the President of the United States because of that meticulousness, the attention to detail, which you see in his style, in his work. But it permeates way beyond that into the intersection of life and art, quite often faith-based things and art. You'll be fascinated to know that his BA in Bucknell, this is a new one on me, that... He had a double major in art and animal behavior. So maybe that explains a lot, Marco, for a long time. They went on to the Tokyo National University and has an MFA in the arts from there and did graduate work there as well toward a doctoral degree. So I think this kind of international look will come clear as well. He has been a guest curator at the Corcoran. He's worked with UNESCO in order to get art to places all over the world that are sponsored by our government. He's at exhibitions likewise all over the world. He's represented by Dillon Gallery in New York City, but he's exhibited recently at the Museum of Biblical Art in New York City, which is a fascinating new museum. He's been doing some really terrific work there in the city. He's also exhibited at the Katzen Museum in Washington, D.C., which is a wonderful museum as well, and at the Seito Museum in Tokyo. And I know he's here today to talk about a project of the four Holy Gospels he's been working on in the last 2 years, and like you, I'm looking forward to his sharing what he's up to with all of us. So, Marco, it's...
We were just walking around and we saw the Frankenthaler there. And I was telling Brian that the last time I saw that painting was at Dick and Lynn Cheney's house, which this museum loaned to them. And the vice president's compound, where the Bidens live now, it's a very limited space, but they do have some nice walls, and they could call the National Gallery and have any of the works come, and of course probably Phoenix Museum as well. But it's nice to see that piece. Helen Frankenthaler, I would say, is a very important female artist of the 20th century. Just passed away, and it was moving for me to see that. Thank you for inviting me to be here today. And the conversation that I had with many of you last night and with Brian this morning has indicated that there's something happening here in Phoenix. And I've only been here twice before, but I now realize there's much potential in the city, and a lot of the council work has to be of thinking about the potentials rather than many failures that we have. Because we live in this world of pragmatism. From our boardrooms to elders' meetings at a church to school board meetings and at home, probably in our dinner time conversations, we're always wrestling between utility, pragmatism, and the world of intuition, the world of poetry. And I've always thought that part of the dehumanized system that we live in and we swim in is partly caused by this fundamental shift away from the affirming the intuitive, the affirming of poetic gifts in society. And so it's not surprising to have a double major in animal behavior at all, because I'm thinking about ecosystems a lot. And that was my interest in studying in this interdepartmental, interdisciplinary major. It's basically liberal arts, education, and I learned then that the delicate ecosystems, the estuaries of the world, needs to be protected because of the valuable resources that it gives to the whole ecosystem. And most importantly, it allows flourishing of humanity if the ecosystem is at work to help us to gift that to the next generation. And same thing can be said about culture. We need to, instead of having these culture wars, ideological battles, we really need mindset of culture care. Culture care is it works in the same way that caring for environment, creation care, as Dr. DeWitt at Wisconsin Madison campus talks about. We have cultural estuaries. We have all these mixture of salt water and fresh water, and the most diverse system in the world. And yet, the same kind of pollution that takes place, the over-industrialization, the commodification of art, all these things lead to death of strange little creatures that swim in culture called artists. And being one of them, I find myself unable to breathe a lot of times. And Washington's probably the worst place to go if you want to do this. But we were so fortunate to have Chairman Dana Gioia, a poet and former business executive who took over the agency in 2003. And I was so privileged to work with him because his vision had allowed us to begin to care for our culture. And I hope that work continues. I'm going to start out with a video, which you may have seen, but whenever we get a nice auditorium like this, I always play this video to begin my conversation. And four people are in it. One is Valerie Dillon, who's been the owner of that, who is the founder and owner of Dillon Gallery in New York City, who I had the privilege of journeying with for close to 15 years. And another person is Alyssa Wilkinson, who is a young critic and a professor. She founded several initiatives, the International Arts Movement, which is a nonprofit that I founded 20 years ago. And Alyssa is going to be talking about the cultural effect of Protestant culture especially. And then Tony Carnes, who is a sociologist who teaches at Columbia University, a friend of mine, is talks about sociological aspect. And then Susie Barra, who is a remarkable percussionist and composer who I have befriended in New York. And so she's going to be saying a little bit. But I want to invite you into my studio in New York. And the materials that I'm using are minimal pigments, crushed azurite, malachite, platinum, and gold powder and bead forms. You'll see me actually creating two pieces for the Four Holy Gospels, and one is a piece called Prodigal God, which is a frontispiece for the Book of Luke, and also the piece that I'm starting in the video is called Consider the Lilies. Consider the Lilies is the frontispiece for the Book of Matthew.
There's a line in the contemporary art world. This is the line: you can paint and you can worship, but don't do them together. And if you step over that line, you're in essence setting yourself up for crucifixion.
I am Makoto Fujimura. I'm an artist, and I am working on a Crossway project to celebrate the 400th anniversary of the King James Bible. And welcome to my studio.
Marco's trained in an ancient technique. It's a Japanese technique. It's called Nihonga, but he uses it in a very expansive sense.
He's looking backwards at a tradition. He really spent the time learning a tradition and learning how to do it well. And at the same time, he's well recognized as a contemporary artist in the mainstream, you know, in your Chelsea galleries and your museums. His work is always, even people who don't understand painting look at his work and kind of go, wow.
I don't think there's one ingredient that makes Marco's art unique. It is his voice. He expresses in his art what his relation to religion and faith is as an artist.
The project is to illuminate four Gospels, Matthew, you to Mark and John. And each of the chapter headings will have a letter that I designed, and then embellishments that go along the sides, and I have complete artistic freedom where we use the best printing possible. So it's one of the few times when contemporary art and the Bible have met. I just got this from the publisher, so I'm just starting to process it. I want to design each page so it reads consistent with the message. It's another way of reading the text.
The New York City art community is still sort of the center of the art community in the world, which meant that he really had to engage the art market here in New York City of one-to-one. Very hard to do.
It's really risky for an artist who's working in the contemporary mainstream of art to be Christian, to be overtly Christian, because people are immediately going to make assumptions about you and what you're trying to say in your art.
Within the art community, there was always sort of a spiritual drift of things, but they didn't want anything that confined them. And they saw that Christianity somehow was confinement, somehow was anti-modern, somehow was anti-development of themselves.
And at the same time, the church is very suspicious of the art world. Christians have had a very contentious relationship with art, especially Protestants and evangelicals have had a really difficult time understanding what's going on in the art world and how they can be involved with it.
Now, here comes Marco illustrating one of the most important cultural artifacts that exists, the Bible. And he's bringing a global perspective, he's bringing a modern art perspective, he's bringing insight to scripture that's so much deeper than maybe most artists, even believers, would have.
I think that having Mako's art, which is non-representational, next to the words of scripture, invites the reader to take the words of scripture and sort of see what they see in the art and how that connects with the words that they're reading. Because the words are transcendent, and the art, in a lot of ways, reflects that transcendence.
Abstraction, 20th century abstraction, has really given me this language to tap into the mystery of creation.
Everything he's been working on for his whole life, this is the reason.
I was thinking about John 1, in the beginning was Word, and Word was with God. So John, to me, is that metaphysical mystery that goes beyond what we can understand.
He would want this to be just right. He's really bringing all of his art and expertise into each piece. He would want this to be just perfect.
And then this painting, which is Gospel of Mark, and I was thinking how Mark is so much about Jesus talking about the judgment fire. Fire is also to sanctify us, to purify us.
So he's taking his craft, he's taking his experience, he's taking his creativity, he's taking his faith, and he's able to produce works that says, this is who I am.
And then Luke, which is a bit more complicated and nuanced.
Just watching him work and talking to him in the studio and looking at the works for the first time. And it is, I think it's the most fun Mark has ever had. Painting ever.
The painting that I'm going to be starting today is Matthew. And that's going to be a very monochromatic painting. Azurite, malachite, monochromatic in his blue image.
Here we go.
If I were to put a few words in reflection of Marco's work, it would be his faith, his family, and his compassion for this world.
Marco really loves artists, and so he started International Arts Women nearly 20 years ago as a way to help artists grapple with how does their art relate to their faith, how does their art relate to their community.
Marco's given a whole group of people confidence to pursue their creativity alongside pursuing their faith.
In the last 100 years, 50 years, we've started to reconnect beauty with truth. And I think Mako's work represents a fusion of that.
It's not just a religious event. It's a cultural event. And it can become that because Mako's doing it here in New York, and he's made it in New York, and his art is such a high level that it will catch attention. I think people will respond to that and say, oh, you know what? Maybe modern art is not so hostile to Christian faith. Maybe it's part of it. And you're going to find that both on the believing side and the non-believing side. You're going to say, you know, there's a new modern art in town. And, you know, it works.
Art is always transgressive, you know, and I what I always say is we need to transgress in love. We today have a language to celebrate waywardness, but we do not have a language, cultural language, to bring people back home. And so everything I do, my paintings with the International Arts Movement work, everything has something to do with that. So I hope this project will be enduring. That is not just a printed object, but it has a life of its own.
I want to thank Plywood Pictures and my son who produced it. It took me 2 years to complete this project, and we just did a tour of the original pieces that ended in Japan, and several places, including Mobia Museum of Folk Art in New York City. And the results have been fascinating all over, and I'll talk more about that maybe at the end. But there are two versions of this that they printed. One's the leather commemorative version, and it's the official size of the entry of the word in Episcopal and Anglican churches. So when my friend Greg Brewer was just, brought into the bishop, become the bishop of consecrated, is the word. Consecrated into being the bishop of Central Florida in the ceremony in Orlando. This he had asked that, you know, if he could use this Bible, I was so honored. And so it can serve in a liturgical function, but it's also the four holy gospels is. It's traditionally one of the ways that a publisher will celebrate the creativity of culture. And yet, when Lane Dennis, the founder of Crossway, when he first called me, I had never spoken to him before. Crossway is the Bible publisher of English Standard Version, which is the lineage of the King James Bible. He said, you know, the 400th anniversary of King James is coming up, which was last year. Would you be interested in us commissioning you to do this project? And by the way, you should know that the illumination of the entire four Holy Gospels has not been done in 400 years. I said, you got to be kidding. So I did my research, and it turns out he is true. There are notable exceptions. St. John's Bible, which Jim just told me was here. Remarkable effort, Donald Jackson and the people in Minnesota has put together this beautiful Bible. But it is a collaboration among artists, and so it's not given to one person. And of course, we have Barry Moser's, to William Blake, who did the Book of Job. But there's this huge gap as we go from the Renaissance times up to now, when the King James was published. of the reality of this schism that took place between the word and visual imagery. To the extent that when they were thinking of putting the 400th anniversary exhibit at MoBA, Museum of Biblical Art in New York City, the director said, you know, this would be very hard to mount at a museum because there are so few visual imagery. So we would like to show your work in the background. And of course, I was honored and delighted to do that. But as I was standing in, as I came into the space for the first time, and to see the illuminated manuscripts of the 13th to 14th century, begin with that, go into the Tinsdale and King James, and then out through the history of modern times up to very recent examples. You notice this gap, this huge schism that is devoid of visual imagery. So I fell into this rabbit hole, and I couldn't get out of it. As I began to work on this project, I began to realize that there is no substantial visual vocabulary to do this. So I would go back to the Kells, Lindbergh brothers, manuscripts in medieval France, look at all the human manuscripts, which is abundantly available now on the web, which is I'm really grateful. You can go online and do your research, and there it comes up, and most of them available for free, so you can just look at these manuscripts, and they're just extraordinary. And as an artist, I know that it took someone their entire lifetime to be able to script that mind, to make that image come alive, to learn to use these materials, which, by the way, are exactly the same materials that I use, minerals and gold and silver and so forth, done on sheepskin or vellum. And so you have this flow throughout history, and yet there's a strange gap for 400 years. So I had to begin by limiting the assignment because I was so overwhelmed. And whenever I work on a project thematically, I begin by identifying its boundaries first. And I tell young artists this all the time, limitations are your friend. Don't fight against it, but hold these boundaries to be sacred, but it is porous. You can go through them and go in and out of them. And there's a kind of a theological premise behind this, which I won't go into. If you're interested, you can ask me later. But it is really the reality of how we are made. We need boundaries. We need limitations. So when you're young, you fight against them and you try to have this idea that true freedom is having no boundaries. But as you grow older, whatever you're doing, the more you master that technique or discipline, you realize that these limitations are good. But they're not rigid. They cannot be rigid. So you start out with. So in this case, I wanted to limit myself intentionally because the project was so enormous and so historic, I guess, in terms of the length of history that you're dealing with. So, because I was so overwhelmed, I chose the shortest verse in the entire Bible, John 11, verse 35, which is, Jesus wept. If you're ever challenged by a pastor to memorize a scripture verse, that's the one you should set out, Jesus wept. But, all joking aside, I have been for the past two Lenten seasons, or now four Lenten seasons, I've been meditating on John 11 and John 12. And this profound passage that takes place in Bethany, before Jesus goes into Jerusalem to be crucified, before Good Friday, and before Maundy Thursday, there is Jesus in Bethany with his friends, Martha and Mary. and Lazarus, who has just died. And this curious and strange passage, which talks about Jesus delaying his coming. He knew that Lazarus was sick. He knew that he could go and cause this miracle to cure him, heal him. But he intentionally delays his coming. And perplexing the disciples, of course. But really, his sisters were distraught by the time Jesus arrives in Bethany. And Martha, the analytical CEO of the family, is trying to understand this rationally. And she is asking Jesus, Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. Why? Basically, she's asking, why did you delay your coming? And there's a famous line about the resurrection. I am the resurrection and life. Martha receives this instruction from Jesus, a very analytical understanding of why this is more than what she thinks it is. And she assents to this. She makes somewhat of a confession to say, yes, this, I do believe that. And then her sister, who is this quintessential artist, Mary, who we know from Luke that she is the one sitting listening to Jesus at the foot of, sitting at his feet and listening to him. And Martha is quite upset because she tried to get organize this gathering together for Jesus, and her sister is doing nothing. And so she tells Jesus to, you know, tell Mary to help me because I'm running around. Can't you see that this is a very busy time? And Jesus says, Martha, Martha, Mary has chosen a better way. And this affirmation of the contemplative. Now, today is Good Friday, and many of the churches do not have Good Friday services. And it's interesting, I was looking into it, I thought, you know, why wouldn't you have Good Friday services? Isn't that the whole point of Christianity? But many churches believe that silence and contemplative devotion is the only way that you can access the mystery of this day. And there's something profound about that. And so for Mary, the artist, the contemplative, she is struggling in a different way than Martha is. And for Mary, this reality of Jesus not coming is not just the rational, analytical, but it's deeply emotional. So she doesn't even come to Jesus. Martha has to call her to come. And when she comes, I can see her visibly upset and emotional, confused, angry. She says, Lord, if you had met here, my brother would not have died. Which is the echo of what her sister said. Exact same words, called in Jaina. But articulated in a completely different way. And it's this reality of why? Why do things happen? Neither, three of them. All the invisible atrocities that we overlook every day in our lives and in the world. People are suffering from illness to despair. I have a good friend who parents who lost their son to suicide. I had him in soccer. I was a coach, coaching my daughter's soccer league. What happened, Jesus? What is this reason? Why we see you We perhaps follow you, we recognize your presence, and yet you have no answer for us. When I painted this painting, which is called The Tears of Christ, Charis Kairos, which means grace time, I was thinking about that gap between what we see, what we believe, and where we are today. This incredible gap that exists, and how artists get caught up in the middle, in the liminal space between heaven and earth. And the Celts call it the thin places. It is literally where angels dwell, and yet artists, with their antennae out, they are able to tap into this and write their songs and articulate something in a production, in a play, in a Shakespeare production. You see something so transcendent come out of the mundane, ordinary realities. And something is pulled out of us at that moment, something miraculous, perhaps. And we're able to touch that garment of heaven, that somehow the veil is torn a bit. And you can see a glimpse of that world in which there is silence, and yet there is music. There is chaos, and yet there is this clarity, this vision for the future. And 20th century art, out of Mark Rothko, Jackson Pollock, to Frank and Paul, I believe addresses that space very well. They have actually tapped into this mystery because of the lack of perhaps the formulaic structure that we may have if we have institutionals or government behind it. Because of the maybe the liminal awareness that these artists possessed intuitively, they were able to tap into something. And they, because there was no other language from which I can draw from to do this project, and because my whole career is based on this reality, actually, I am using, I'm borrowing the language of de Kooning, language of Rothko, language of particularly Osho Boki, who is this little-known artist who influenced everybody else in New York City, and Kazimir Malevich. All these 20th century artists are very seminal to me as a visual vocabulary. So for those of you who are not steeped in that language, and if you're here in a museum and walking around, standing in front of a Frankenthaler and doesn't quite understand what's going on there, there is a vocabulary, visual vocabulary, that's been developed in 20th century that is quite substantial and metaphysical. And so for me, the engagement of this journey through faith into John 11, it necessitated revisitation and using the language, visual vocabulary that I've inherited through Rothko. And of course, 16th century Japanese painters understood this as well. The liminal space conversation. There is a phenomenal exhibit at the National Gallery. Let me digress a little bit to implore you to go see this. If you are ever in Washington area, it's only till 29th of this month because the works are so delicate. It is an 18th century work by a Japanese master, Jakuchu. Jakuchu is his name, and 30 scrolls that's been held by the Imperial Palace, never shown before. Until 2 years ago, I was fortunate enough to be invited to the opening in the National Gallery of Japan. So I went, and these 30 scrolls, okay, were done 10 years prior to the Declaration of Independence. And in such impeccable condition that you would think it was painted yesterday. And it is literally, I sat there like blinking my eyes because I couldn't believe that this is. And Rossi Powell, who is our friend at the National Gallery, was kind enough to host this, so it's very difficult to do this today. You have to have the right climate, you know, in the gallery. And for the centennial anniversary of cherry blossoms being exchanged to Washington, D.C., I think Jakchū is the Michelangelo of Japan. He's a genius, of extraordinary genius, and his works, these particular scrolls, 30 scrolls that he painted for his family, actually, and donated to the temple that he worshipped at, are the 16 chapel paintings of Japan. And it's only there until the 29th of April. So I'm trying to get everybody there if possible. Okay, so let me go back to my work. Jakchū, Hasegawa, Tohaku, all these artists of Japanese art is as critical to me. Their language speaks of this liminal mystery. And so they're in there as well. So this piece is called Tears of Christ. Again, the entire project is framed around Jesus wept. So I am literally meditating on this profound reality that we live in, that when 2,000 years ago, when Jesus wept, and Jesus wept, not because he was asked by Martha the rational question, which is the right question to ask, but why? But Jesus wept because he saw Mary's tears, the artist weeping for her brother and angry at him. He saw love there. He saw this deep level of devotion. And so he wept. And I think about that moment, and I think, how irrational, right? Couldn't he just have told Mary, same thing with Martha, you know, Mary, I have come to raise your brother from the grave, don't you want to see that? It's going to be spectacular. I have this power to wipe away your problems right now. And you gotta get to see this. I'm sorry I'm late, but that's the reason. That's what I would say. I mean, if God gave me the power to go back to 9/11, to reverse the curse, reverse the time, if God gave me the power to say, Marco, I'm gonna give you the power and to wipe away what happened on 9/11, or 3/11 in Japan, wouldn't I just exercise that power immediately and tell people, don't you have faith in God? This is what God can do. But Jesus doesn't. He weeps. And it's the most extraordinary moment to me in the Bible, because there's no reason to. It's not only irrational, it's transrational. It doesn't have any purpose other than that he is Mary's friend. He understands the depth of her emotions and her anger, her fears, her confusion. He understands that. And he's going to weep. He's going to waste time weeping. But those tears, right, they fell into the hard grounds of Bethany, got soaked into the soil, and they evaporated, went into the air, and we breathe those tears today. Physically, we breathe Jesus' tears today. So I'm thinking, at the studio, as I mix my pigments with high glue and water, I'm painting with Jesus' tears. He continues to weep for me, for the world, for all that is wrong with this world. And I have this privilege of holding those tears, precious, ephemeral tears in my hands, and then pour them out onto the canvas, onto the paper, onto the silk, and see it spread. And that is this painting. All of these paintings are done in the same technique. This is the piece that you saw me starting on this video. 60, 70 layers of thinly washed malachite and azurite over and over, done onto a paper which is no longer being made today. Unfortunately, the paper maker who makes these large paper has passed away, and though it's been passed down to the next generation, it's not the same. And the texture, the evenness, you know, the surface is not the same. So I this was one of the last pieces that I had from 10 years ago when I purchased these rolls from him directly. And I wanted to honor that beauty of the surface of this paper, which is like rag paper. It's very thick, so you can stretch it over canvas. And it sits so even, the surface is so even, that when you paint on it, it just glides. And the pigments stay right in the pores perfectly. So you can do these layers, and each layer is, it holds itself. It doesn't move. So your eye, when you stand in front of these paintings, you can actually detect the 60 layers that's on there. But a mind says, no. It's just a blue painting. Walk away. You just categorized it. That's all you need to see. It's just a blue painting. It poses no danger to you. You see a truck, run away before you get hit. But a painting has no place in our lives. So, we walk away. And we walk away from ephemeral things like lilies of the field. We just step on it, we walk away, we use it to start a campfire in the evening because it's so spindly. But Jesus says in Matthew 6, right? Do not be anxious about this, what you wear or what you eat. And then we Christians are so good at this. We often think about, you know, what Jesus is saying, and then we skip to the part, the pragmatic part. So Matthew 6 starts with, do not be anxious. And we memorize, seek God's kingdom first and his righteousness. And all these things will be added unto you. So we memorize that, and we think about it, we meditate on it, we act on that. But we forget the passages before. Seek God's kingdom first. And that's when Jesus tells the disciples, consider the lilies. See the birds of the air. And I can see the disciples thinking, like, what does that have to do with anything? You know? Like the danger we face every day, you know, and this reality of, okay, we're following you, but, you know, like, where's our food, and how do we deal with all this crowd that's following us? I mean, why are you talking about birds? Why are you saying, look at the lilies, which is this little wildflower, which is just everywhere when you wake up in the morning and they disappear in the evening? What are you talking about, Jesus? But Emily Dickinson said, considering the lilies is the only commandment that I have ever obeyed. Mm-hmm. Artists, poets, understand the part that we miss. Emily Dickinson's of the world understands that when we miss the ephemeral realities, we miss what is enduring. We easily distort our perception of beauty into this commoditized frenzy, into a celebrity-driven world, and play this power game with each other. But when she opted out of that, she knew that considering the lilies is not this frivolous activity for her as a poet. It is the only way that she can be faithful to the world that she was given. Artists see that. They tap into it. And they can describe to you in secret, reveal those things that we are missing every day in life. And so I was thinking about her when I painted this. And you see, it's hard to see in this. Probably the prints will be a little better because they're hand embellished. When you see platinum and gold in the lilies, there's a lily painted with sumi ink, which is about 100-year-old ink, which was given to me by a Nihonga master. Nihonga is the Japanese-style paintings that I studied in Japan for 6.5 years, use of these materials. And she gave me this sumi ink that has been around for about 100 years, and it's almost sacred to me. And I only use it in special projects, but I wanted to paint a lily that's a little bit funky. Because I wanted to reimagine what a lily, Easter lilies, look like in the post-resurrection world, in between, perhaps, our world and the next. What would it look like, the generative lilies that's starting to come alive? And so when you see this, that's what I'm... That's why they're a little bit funky and unusual. And I'll just go through these fairly quickly because I want to get to question and answer. And this is actually a perfect painting to see today, Good Friday, to meditate on the fire of sacrifice and how. This is my homage to Rothko as well, and Mark Rothko, who is a Jewish artist, who is actually, there's a play now called Red, which is really an extraordinary play, and it's about Rothko and his assistant, their conversation in the studio as he's painting, and the red is the color of his understanding of the liminal space. And to me, I wanted to create an image, and I created this title of this piece is called Water Flames. I wanted to create an image in which flames are not just destructive, but they are purifying. That flames that I dealt with over and over in my mind after 9/11, I had to fight this temptation to live in fear and despair, but to turn that into this sanctifying flames of God. I don't understand how that works, but I know poets like T.S. Eliot and Dante understood that. So to me, it was a battle of going back in time to revisit Rothko again. I went to Rothko Chapel in Houston thinking about this. And then to read Eliot, read Dante, read Virgil, because it all goes back, you see, in time. There's our time is not unique or isolated. There is ample resources that we can draw upon. They are saints of the past, cloud of witnesses, clouds of artistic witnesses or whatever, that is there for me to draw upon. So I'm, in a very simple way, I'm going back and trying to rediscover that vision. And this one is the most complex piece called Prodigal God. That is a title I stole from my pastor, Tim Keller, whose book, Prodigal God. If you're interested in this, what the Bible is all about, read this book. He preaches on this passage in Luke about the famous prodigal story, the prodigal son story, it's known as. But he, whenever he talks about this passage, I hear him say prodigal God story, that prodigal son. And he starts out by explaining that the word prodigal is not, was not a negative word in Shakespearean times. The word prodigal meant being recklessly spendthrift. So it means spending all you have for the sake of others, to create this commonwealth in the world. And so the real prodigal in the story is not the younger son who wastes away all his father's inheritance, but the father who is willing to welcome him back and have a party, kill the fatted calf and invite the village, and willing to say, son, you have come home. We're going to celebrate. And unlike the elder brother, who is so painfully trying to do the right thing, and yet he has no interest in pleasing the father, he just wants the inheritance himself. What he should have done is to go out and try to find his younger brother, if he loved him at all. Spend his inheritance to do that. But no, he didn't. He stayed home, had a checklist of things to do for his father, and he did them diligently. So he was rather upset when his father was spending his considerable wealth, but his inheritance, meaning his part of the inheritance, on this wayward younger brother. I can understand that. I have both sides in me, you know. And elder brother, and younger brother. I kind of go back and forth every day. And so this painting is divided in half. It's split right in half, which is something you should not do if you're a visual artist. It's almost impossible to resolve a painting, and it's not resolved. But I wanted to start with this impossible theme because the story is impossible. It is about how to have grace when everything in you is not built for that. And who is this father anyways that would love us despite wasting away his inheritance? And so I actually have the words from Luke right in there, in gold, and probably on the print you can see this. And finally, this is Gospel of John. In the beginning, I talked a little bit about this in the video, the mystery of God's creation. John 1 echoing Genesis 1. This reality of creation and how Jesus came to usher in this new creation. And so, this is John 11, the letter for the chapter, chapter heading, and it's my favorite one. It's an N, now in Bethany, is how it says. And of course, it's very abstract, right? So I called the publisher and I said, you know, is it okay? We can't really tell that it's an N. And he said, oh, people figure it out, don't worry about it. But I found the problem is there are many A's and T's in the following gospel. So I had to become very inventive and do all sorts of A's. But when I put it together, I was really amazed that actually that John 11 piece is the still point. of the turning world. And there are all sorts of things happening, and I see this as my kind of vision for the cultural estuary that I talked about in the beginning. Complex, unresolved perhaps, but still there is this element of enormous beauty that can resonate out of what you intended and what you didn't intend. So, here are some pages. You can take a look at the Bible itself. And I have written just recently on these lines and why they show up in the Bible a lot. There are no explicit imagery of Jesus on the cross. And I wondered about that too, because I was focused on Jesus' tears. I felt the boundary that I set up in a way limited me, but also freed me. Because you can see the cross of Jesus implicitly in every page without trying to explain it. How do you do that? And I'll end with this. These lines. When I began the Nihonga journey of studying for 6.5 years in Japan, I spent the first 6 months just drawing lines. They gave me different brushes, different paper, different kind of semi ink, and then they eventually allowed me to use minerals. And I can draw lines or pour minerals into these lines. And later on, I got to know the use of gold and platinum and silver, and I was able to use them as well. Whenever there is an argument going on between Jesus and Pharisees, the Pharisees, the religious authorities of the day who had long checklists of how to please God, and of course on the outside they looked quite religious, but internally they were hypocrites, you know, because you were doing these things to be God. Rather than to serve God, to have power over people. So if you're not following these rules, then you can say, hey, you're not following these rules. So, you know, pay more money or something like that. I don't know how it went, but it's basically the way to control your relationship with your God, but you can't. You just can't do that. And so whenever there's this argument, you know, like with Jesus, you know, because he's like, you don't understand how this works. You don't understand the love of the Father. But then I'm reminded that, you know, Jesus did not come to abolish the law, but to fulfill the law. So he was navigating inside that corrupt religious system and political system. And he could have opted out, but he didn't. He stayed with it, and it cost him his life. Because it was that system, together with us, putting him toward the cross. But here, in many, many chapters, I have these lines. And because they're the representative symbolism for this law that we all have in our institutional realm and rules, you know. And but then I realized what I have learned in Nihonga was to inject into these lines gold and vermilion and colors, thereby fulfilling what the lines can do and making it come alive. And in this passage, same thing. Pharisees and Jesus intently arguing about issues, disciples around them trying to keep people at bay because they're having the serious theological discussion. And I made a mistake on top. You can't really see it on this, but there's a drip on top. And I was going to start over. You know, I said, oh, shoot. And I got a new sheet of paper out, and then I started reading this passage. And in the bottom, what happens is they're having this discussion, and children. That's okay. Perfect. Children invaded the serious discussion. That's exactly what should happen. And the disciples are like, no. You just gotta stay away. And Jesus says, welcome those children. Come then, sit with me. Because for these belong the kingdom of God. And so, instead of doing a new one, I just had fun. I said, okay, we're gonna have fireworks here. We're gonna play. We're gonna make a real beautiful mess. And one of the greatest experiences that I had doing this tour of the four Holy Gospels was I was showing these images at Azusa Pacific University in Los Angeles, and they had the King James exhibit, which was in the library next to the gallery, and the gallery where they showed the original pieces. And this group of special education children was given a tour. And they went to the library first. They saw all the tins, their Bibles and King James. And then they came into the gallery side in which there were my paintings displayed. And they're like, they couldn't connect the two. You know, it doesn't make sense to them. Like what's happening here? Because you told me that this is the Bible now. What's going on here? And the teacher showed the Bible and turned the pages, and they recognized that these paintings were the same paintings. And they said, the teacher said, it was as if life came back into their faces. And they said, do you mean that we can draw in the Bible? And the teacher said, yes. Let the children come to me, right? And how much of this gap we're experiencing in culture today between ourselves, dehumanized reality, and humanized, you know, this place of thriving has to do with this set of things that we have made up for ourselves. That we don't let the children come to us to play and to experience what they're seeing, and how much we're missing, and how much we can learn from that. And so part of cultural care is to care for these conversations that gets exposed in these types of exhibits, and I'm sure it will happen here, even in this print exhibit. And I hope I can be a service to you as you navigate this pragmatic, dehumanized world, and help you to see that your own childlike, creative, beautiful mess that you can make is important to God. He does not miss it. He wants that to be part of your relationship, and how we can so easily, even as an artist, you know, try to fix it, make it right, do the right painting where there are no mistakes. I don't think that's how God wants that painting to be, and that's what I discovered during this journey, and I'm grateful for that. And let me take some questions. I want to thank again Brian and Jim for hosting, and thank you very much for this time. Any questions or thoughts to address?
You talk a lot about tension, and I know that life must include tension for you just in the different worlds that you occupy, and even including the world of Washington, D.C., where, you know, the continuing comment is just that we're getting further and further apart from each other.
Yeah.
And I guess my question is for you personally, do you ever just, you seem like such a peaceful person, and I'm sure that partly that's what God has gifted you in that way. Do you ever just feel like you're going to like go off one side or the other? And how do you deal with the tension that you face all the time?
I have a wife who's a psychotherapist. Her website is judycares.com. So a lot of this culture care language comes from her. And no, it's a great question. I struggle with depression from time to time. And it hits me very deeply when when things are not right. And you know, and the funny thing is, it was actually easier for me to deal with all the stuff in Washington D.C. It was harder for me to deal with it within the church. That's very painful to me. And because I know the level that it can attain to, when you have community, when you have people thriving under grace, and but when things go wrong, and of course we have issues to deal with, you know, like 9/11, that's a big one, 3/11, you know, we lost 20,000 people on 3/11 and tsunami in northern Japan. There are 200,000 people still homeless. But what's more despairing is, since 3/11 last year until recent anniversary, 50,000 people in Japan committed suicide. So we lost more people in despair than we did in the disaster. And that's an astounding number. But I fear that the same kind of things going on here too. What's on the surface, maybe we have it all together, maybe we don't. But culturally speaking, we are desperate for hope. And you know, for many years early in my career, I didn't intend to do this, but I walked right into this ideological reality in which beauty was not allowed. And so I just didn't really care, so I began to exhibit, you know, works using gold, and no one was using gold at the time, and people were like criticizing, you know, this is imperialistic, you know, you can't use that now, and it was just a way for me to honor, and also gold is such an amazingly complex material that you can literally feel something happening in front of you organically, although it's a metal, you know. And the light, how light refracts on gold is so different from any other material. So I'm using gold, and this is, you know, early 90s. And people couldn't get it. Why would you do that? You know, it's not PC, you know, it's not. But the reason I realized later was, you know, why I continue to do that is because I need hope. I need beauty in my life. I'm sorry, but I can't live without it. I'm desperate for it. Every day, I need it. So when I go into my studio, I need to be able to encounter the splendor of the materials that I'm using, the history of them, how I know the paper makers, the silk makers, the people who pulverize these pigments, and how they accidentally found these minerals, and the stories behind it. They give me hope that maybe today something can happen, that I can experience a miraculous. Just small glimpse of that would be enough to carry me, to not fall into despair. And so for me, having hope is not an optimist escape. It's the only way. It's the only way I can live. And I lived in Ground Zero for a long time. We recently moved to the Princeton area. So that whole time of raising our children in Ground Zero conditions, facing that hole every day. And then I traveled to places like Northern Japan, and I see firsthand the despair that people are in, and it is overwhelming. And I can't really say that I can do anything about it, because I can't. But I realized, when I was doing this exhibit in Japan, and people came to my shows, and they would stand in front of these paintings for a long, long time without saying a word. I didn't know many of those people. And to know that they're in this place, right, of despair. If 50,000 people commit suicide, how many people think about it, So I brought these choir, youth choir from college in Pennsylvania with me, because I knew that there would be an opportunity for them to sing in the streets of Ginza, Tokyo, where the exhibit was. But I also wanted them to go up north and sing, just sing. And when people gathered around them, just to listen to them singing, I could tell there was this battle going on in their minds, that this was not just, oh, let's listen to music. But they were asking the same question too. They were saying, is there hope? Is there hope for me to keep living? And so to me, art is not just this peripheral luxury. It's an absolute necessity. And so I that's why it's so important for me to do what I can in my limited ways to help whatever I can to the NEA, to the church, whatever I can do, because I know this really matters. So, yes.
Would it be accurate to say that you believe that beauty is a universal unifier?
Well, beauty is, I believe, pre-existent. To before the world ever was, beauty existed. So, in that sense, it does force this synthesis to happen. And in the fragmentation that we've been experiencing, because of modernistic thinking in all spheres, sciences and the arts, and we have created these neat categories, and then put them in nice little cubby holes and denominations and religions and whatever you want to call that, political ideologies, whatever you want to call that, it's all there. And we think we have solved the problem because we have put people into neat categories, which is, by the way, keeps fragmenting. But experientially, we know that's not going to solve any problem. So yes, beauty brings things together. It forces this co-joining of elements that has been fragmented and has been even lost in modern conversations. And that's another reason why the arts are fundamental need in society, because there's really no other mechanism that can bring all the elements together. Now, if you, I won't go any further because it's going to bring us into a deep theological and philosophical territory. But yes, I believe that. That should have been my answer. I'm getting in trouble. Yes, sir.
Is your Bible that you can ask for this book?
Yes, you can get it on Amazon. But if you go to my website, I'll sign it. Yes, it's a actually we have some samples here. That's going to be here available, but you can also get it online. And yes, it is available in bookstores as well. I've seen them around. So yeah. Yes, sir.
You mentioned that.
Yes.
Deal with that. You see that as a mistake.
Yeah. Well, you know, I guess I've learned all the time that mistakes are not really mistakes, and but in a sense, you know, you learn to fail well, and failure is very important. And I was really happy to find out that a lot of the early illuminators, manuscripts done in 8th century, these. Monks did exactly the same thing. They made mistakes. And they couldn't, the materials are so valuable, they couldn't erase them. So that's why all these doodles came out on the margins. And you see like monkeys jumping around, and like you wonder like, why does this house song has, you know, a monkey jumping around? And it was just, they decided, go with it, play with it. You know, allow the abundance of God to be displayed in the margins. And so I think, in a sense, when this happened, I realized that that was permitted to in the legacy of the illuminated tradition. So I thank God for the monkeys. Okay, one more question? Anybody? Okay, yes, ma'am.
When you do your work, and you were talking about different times when you get depressed with the things that go on, are there times where when you do your work, because you're so into it, and especially from like a spiritual, religious kind of point of view, that you're like either totally just wiped out because you put so much of yourself into it, or other times where it's the exact opposite, where you're just totally energized because you
Yeah. Well, I was really exhausted when I did this, and when I finished it, I came out of the studio, and my studio is located in the back of the International Arts Movement, so Brian Holbath, who's the executive director, is there, and it's great because I have community, you know, and I kind of stumbled out, and oh man, I feel like I just ran the triathlon twice, you know. Which I have never done. I never done. That's what I felt like. completely exhausted. At times, going through, it was such a dark journey because doing this project, it just exposes everything. There's no place to hide. And so you're really literally navigating in the depth of your soul. And realizing that you're completely unworthy to do this. There's nothing that I can justify before anybody, even myself, that I would illumine the Bible. That's ridiculous. But then, for those of you who are more theologically minded, I have this cycle that I go through between Romans 7 and Romans 8. And Romans 7 is a passage where Paul is confessing what a wretched man that I am. You know, how I cannot even do the things that I want to do. You know, and I end up doing things that I know I'm not supposed to be doing. And then, of course, Romans 8 is this grand soliloquy of there's nothing that can separate us from the love of Christ, right? And the linking word is extraordinary to think. Between 7 and 8, it is not but, it's because I'm a wretched man, but God is great and Christ is going to solve all the problems. It's not because I'm a wretched man, yet nevertheless, there's hope. Now the linking word is therefore. What is that? I asked all sorts of theologians. what does that, you know, do a semantic trace on this. I don't understand. Why is it there for? And it is the most powerful word if you can embrace it. It's like, it will allow you to realize the stuff that you're going through, the despair that you are in now, has a purpose. You can't see it. You don't know it, and you don't want to know it. But it's there for. Therefore, there is now no condemnation for those who are in Christ Jesus. Because the law of the Spirit, the law of the Spirit of life has set me free from the law of sin and death. That's those lines. And I don't need anything else. But, you know, so I constantly go back and forth. And as I'm working and as I'm dealing with all sorts of issues, and that's perhaps one way that I can creatively re-engage with my wretchedness as well. Because that's important for artists to do. We are called into a place where we have to be absolutely authentic and honest, where there is no place to hide. And that's sometimes a hard place to be. And we need people around us who, like my wife, who suffer along with me, and thank God she's not an artist. But she knows the art of therapy, which I'm so grateful for. But thank you for